Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents How to Train Your Dog with Love and Science, a dog lover's guide to animal behavior and positive reinforcement training by Annie Grossman, narrated by Eunice Wong. Preface. Eat your homework. I think at some level of my teenage consciousness, I truly believed that the whole point of going to school was to learn how to focus attention on subject matter that was of no consequence to me. John Cleese. When I was growing up, school was the last place I ever wanted to be. My education started out okay, but everything kind of devolved once I entered classrooms where there were no finger paints. The intended missions were accomplished. I learned to read, write, and do some math. I can tell you a handful of things about history, although which of those things I learned in class and which I learned from listening to the Hamilton soundtrack is something I cannot say. School never felt like a place where I was choosing to be. There was so much being told what to do. I complained endlessly to my parents, but they too were being controlled by the threat of punishment in the form of truancy laws. I remember my dad patting me on the back as he dropped me off one morning. "You only have to get through 11 more years," he said. For years, I slouched through an educational system whose parameters were carefully constructed to prescribe certain behaviors and hinder others. There was literally a guard at the door making sure I stayed in the building. As I matured, my behavior was molded by a growing knowledge of consequences. Even when I succeeded, I often felt the sting of failure. The world around me seemed to shine the brightest lights on exception and talent, not on okayness. You could get more than half the answers right on a test, and it'd still be considered a fail. If I had difficulty understanding a concept or expressing something in the right way, I considered myself at fault. I was lacking something. I tried to not cause trouble since I feared the consequences of veering off the narrow path I seemed to be allowed to walk. In discussing this once with a friend, she told me that her mother often warned her that poor behavior would result in consequences. She thought consequences was an illness. What did I think the consequences were going to be if I didn't do well at school? I had cartoon-like ideas of cascading disasters that would result. I was stressed out about my future, and I wasn't even old enough to cross the street alone. Socializing at school was not always easy either. When other kids weren't particularly nice or anyone was socially uncomfortable for any reason, there was the mandate that we all needed to learn to work it out. It was as if school were a microcosm of what the adult world was going to hand us. Like in the class seating chart of life, you may find yourself perpetually next to the school bully, and you're going to have to learn to deal. There's no easy way out, kid. In the pie chart of my youth, school and homework took up a Pac-Man-shaped portion of time. The rest of the time, I was too exhausted to do much of anything at all. I napped a lot. I was put on medication. This is life, I thought. I would grow up and be spit out into some expanded version of this. Nothing to look forward to. Each September, I counted the months until I would be out of school and swore I'd never be a teacher. How cruel, I thought, to have to be in school forever. Well, I didn't become a teacher. I started my own school. And every day, I'm thrilled to go to work. At my school, public displays of affection are not discouraged. In fact, a lot of the teachers and the students are actually in love with each other. There are no grades, no arguments, and no aging out of nap time. Recesses are sprinkled throughout the day, and if there is a social interaction that isn't ideal, future meetings of those individuals will not be forced. At my school, success is a moving target. It moves closer when necessary to ensure a certain amount of success whenever possible. If a student gets something wrong, we ask ourselves how we can be better teachers. Also, the students love the food. In fact, we let them eat their homework. Welcome to School for the Dogs. Introduction. Aliens Among Us. If you see two life forms, one of them's making a poop, the other one's carrying it for him, who would you assume was in charge? Jerry Seinfeld. If you love your dog, there's a good chance you're confused. Both of you. You're not confused about your love for each other, to be sure, but have you ever considered what a strange relationship you're in? As modern dog owners, we are asking our Yorkie poos to live in a world they didn't choose, a world that isn't so simple. We bring these well-intentioned creatures into our homes and often don't do them the favor of explaining how arbitrary rules can be or what our expectations are. We expect dogs to be polite and compliant despite not knowing our language, calm, confident, and collected, although they're a fraction of our size and easily stepped on. Food should only be eaten if it's on the floor in a bowl, but not if it's on the floor and it's not in a bowl, and not from a bowl if the bowl is on the counter. Don't chew a slipper unless it's a chew toy that happens to be in the exact shape of a slipper. It's okay to pee on the AstroTurf at the dog park, but not on the doormat that feels nearly identical under one's paws. It's almost like dogs are alien visitors trying to figure it all out. Except that they didn't choose to be here, and there is no UFO waiting to take them back home. Things aren't so easy for you, either. The consensus about how to teach a dog to be the companion you want is... there is no consensus. Dog training is a largely unregulated industry, and misinformation is rampant. No wonder so many people and dogs are confused. Should there be an even balance of carrot and stick? Must you be a domineering alpha? If so, what does that even mean? Will you spoil a dog by giving treats? What about sleeping on the bed? Should you feed your dog raw beef out of your hand or serve kibble in a crate? People do their best to figure it out, and that's fine, right? Most of the time, perhaps. But some of the time, I would say too often, dogs trained with baseless theories and crude techniques will end up stressed, which can end up stressing out their people. This can result in ruined relationships, maimed people, and euthanized dogs. We're all animals. We humans may think of ourselves as a reasonable bunch, but we sure do nutty things when it comes to dogs. I grew up surrounded by smart, gentle people who seemed to know things about dogs. I didn't doubt them. They were adults, after all. My parents would whack our dogs on the nose with two fingers when they were bad. My uncle, the first person I ever saw let a dog lick him all over his mouth, recently greeted my dog by getting down on all fours. He then attempted to feed her a treat from his mouth. Somehow, dogs put up with us, and even forgive us. Hey, our intentions are good. They keep coming back to us. But that might be only because we don't let them have the car keys. Here's the good news. You may be confused, but you know more than you think you do about dogs and dog training. When you begin to piece together the basics of the science that informs what we know about animal behavior, you can often take a shortcut by considering how you behave in the world. Don't forget, you are an animal too. Dogs and their people are everywhere and always learning, not just at dog school and not just when they're young. Be it accidentally or intentionally, we are learning how to exist in the environment we're in all the time. Truly, the whole world is our school. You can't escape. Conditioning, aka learning. When we start seeing how learning happens, we can try to set up our dogs for success in any environment and make learning so enjoyable for them and us that they and we will keep coming back. With this book, you can become your dog's favorite teacher. Your world, wherever you are, will be your classroom, and your dog will be your favorite student. Spoiler alert, you can get to that halcyon homeroom without attempting to tap into some mysterious internal power or asserting your will. You're about to learn how the science behind learning has evolved over the last century, paving the way to make it possible to train without punishment and coercion. We have developed technologies of behavioral science to help learners learn effectively with little to no error, to keep them happy and engaged. School could be a place not just for filling minds with information, but also for keeping the learners happy. In the decade and change since Kate Sinise and I founded School for the Dogs, a two-story storefront in Manhattan's East Village, we have worked with some 10,000 dog owners locally and around the world virtually. We specialize in helping dogs who have behavior issues stemming from the stresses and confines of urban living. We have worked with countless breeds at every stage of their lives, in addition to teaching clients privately, in their homes, online, and at our school. We also offer a variety of group classes, from puppy kindergarten, which focuses on socialization and teaching basic behaviors, to sidewalk psychos, which helps dogs learn to coexist on leash with other dogs in close proximity. It's a neat place. When I work the front desk, I see an awesome thing that happens all the time. The dog students play what I call reverse hooky, standing at our front door, begging to come in even when we are closed. At the end of the school day, they often try to stay, their owners sometimes having to literally scoop them up and carry them out. Our goal with School for the Dogs was to create a good school, in that we would offer good dog training for people who want their dogs to be good, as in, "Who's your good boy?" Often we say that rhetorically. We are talking to a dog, after all. But it's a really good question. What do we mean by good? What is good training? And what is a good dog? Good dog. No bad dogs is a popular refrain among some dog trainers. I agree there are no bad dogs, but I'm also not sure there are good ones. Good is a label whose definition may be one thing to one person and another to someone else. It also is going to change based on context. A dog's behavior seems good or bad according to our human expectations about what we think the dog should or shouldn't do in a given environment, in a given situation. Humans have wanted dogs to chase and round up livestock, flush game from bushes or dispatch rats from ships, bark to alarm us of trespassers, attack strangers, pull sleds, and so on. We bred them for these tendencies and called them good dogs. Today, my clients often want their dogs to do the opposite or very different things. They want them not to chase things, or pull, or bark every time the guy in Unit 17A takes out his trash. We want them to relax with us on the couch at night, even if they haven't been outside all day pulling sleds or herding sheep. Not only are many of our modern human expectations unnatural for dogs, but we also make their lives even more confusing by shifting our expectations in different situations. I once heard one of my training idols, Kathy Sadeo, imagine aloud that a dog's daily life must be like when you're going through airport security and you get reprimanded for holding up the line because you're untying your shoes, which is what you thought you were supposed to do. But today, they're not doing that. And the TSA guy is looking at you like you're trying to cause a problem when really, you're just trying to do the right thing and have it be done with. No one is applauding good intentions in a crazy, ever-shifting environment. Often, when our dogs don't do what we want, it's easier to blame the dog than it is to change the setting or our expectations. It's easier, but it's often not conducive to behavior change. If we want to free ourselves from this fruitless blame game, we can start to reframe how we think about behaviors we don't like. Much bad dog behavior is, in a different light, a dog being really good at being a dog. Their behavior may only be a problem because the human world is an unnatural environment for them, no more so than in a noisy, crowded, paved, car-swarming, leash-requiring city. We can get away from labels by focusing on how we can be better at effectively getting dogs to willingly engage in behaviors we want. We can also build our ability to better understand them when they're letting us know about their needs. I wrote this book to help you start to better teach your dog, read your dog, think about what behaviors you want from your dog, and then get those behaviors to happen more often. There are countless things any person might want their dog to be or do, but in the broadest sense, there is one single thing that I think makes a dog good. You. Now, that doesn't mean that your dog is good because you are. In Chapter 2, you'll learn why I do not adhere to the common school of thought that our dog's issues are simply a reflection of our issues. I don't think they're little blank slates either, but I do think we can help them be as good as they can be in the world we're asking them to live in by working to be good guardians of them. We can do this by working to understand how to encourage behaviors we want without using force or coercion, assessing what behaviors we can teach that will help them live as comfortably and healthfully as possible in the human realm, learning how they communicate when they are uncomfortable before they feel the need to flee or become aggressive, creating learning environments that give them parameters within which they're bound to succeed, approaching training as a game where both sides feel like they are winning. I believe that anyone who is looking to help their dog, whether they're trying to start out right with a new puppy or are facing some challenges with a dog that's already in the home, has good intentions. They're good humans, if you will. I'm lucky to have been able to steer so many of these kinds of humans toward a way of seeing their dogs, communicating with them cooperatively, and learning about the science of behavior on the way. I bet you are one of these good humans. Good humans who don't just have good dogs, they have the best ones. I mean, isn't yours the best? Good dog training. The work we do at School for the Dogs can truly be transformational for the humans as well as their dogs. When I first got into dog training, I wasn't shopping around for a shift in worldview. I didn't think it would lead me to discussions with ex-cons about using dog training to help people see how it's possible to get out of the loop of using punishment, or with the libertarian candidate for president on how operant conditioning works. I didn't think I'd have long conversations with people about types of dog training or what they were called. What I now like to simply refer to as good dog training goes by many names, among them science-based training, reward-based training, force-free training, and clicker training. Like many trainers, I use a small plastic box that makes a click-clunk sound, but you can clicker train without a clicker. I do it all the time. Clicker training is a technique for what is frequently called positive reinforcement training. I refer to myself as a positive reinforcement trainer as shorthand, but I think there are problems with this label. Positive reinforcement is at work all around us all the time. Anyone who attempts to train a dog is sometimes going to use positive reinforcement, on purpose or by accident. Another problem I see with the positive reinforcement label is that it's easy to misinterpret the positive as having something to do with being smiley and nicey-nice. In fact, these qualities are not essential to a good dog trainer, and the positive, in this context, just refers to a consequence in the form of something added to the equation, as when we add peanut butter to a dog's mouth following a good behavior to increase the likelihood that a dog will do that behavior again. Positive reinforcement should also not be confused with positive thinking. Thinking good thoughts about your dog may or may not solve your problems. I have certainly called myself a reward-based trainer at times, but I worry it implies that we humans are just goody dispensers when there's so much more to it than that. I tend to like the term science-based because today's trainers are using and developing technologies that employ what we understand about science to develop ways of teaching and understanding the animals we are setting out to train. We're also, ideally, staying on top of the latest research and scholarship to inform our training. However, you could train using painful techniques, and that would be operating in the realm of science as well. There's plenty of evidence that animals learn from pain, but I think there's a lot of compelling evidence that it's smarter to avoid it, especially when avoiding it means you can stop having to do ethical gymnastics in order to justify cattle prodding your best friend. So I've taken to just calling it good dog training. It's good in multi-dimensions. It's good in that it works, good in that it is kind, and also good in that both people and dogs tend to like doing it. While its principles are timeless, good dog training is also new in the sense that it isn't what most people think of when they think of dog training. Good dog training doesn't require you to project a certain kind of energy or change your personality to be more alpha and become the leader of a pack. On the other hand, good dog training is more than teaching specific behaviors and practicing those behaviors over and over, more than using a specific handling technique, so much more. At School for the Dogs, we don't just teach dogs good behaviors and neat tricks. We help our human students learn to communicate with their dogs and, in the process, sometimes see the world anew. Good dog training builds confidence, letting dogs make choices that are informed rather than doing things because they're guessing. Don't we all feel better when we make choices based on knowledge? Lack of good communication on our end has helped dogs become a species that's good at hedging their bets. A well-educated dog is better at figuring us out, better at guessing right. And a well-educated dog wants to be in school, wherever in the world school is. In the coming sections, my goal is to do four things. First, I want to talk about the recent history of dog training and help you start to reframe what the term even means. I'll walk you through my personal journey, how I went from thinking about dog training one way, if I thought about it at all, to wanting to sing from the hilltops about how excited I am to see a new wave of dog owners opening themselves up to the possibilities of good, science-based dog training. The science of behavior is the subject of the next part of the book. I'm not a scientist. I have no graduate degrees. I wasn't aware there was a science of behavior until I went to vocational school. But professional dog training left me wanting to read everything I could about the laws of learning. There are laws, who knew? And surround myself with people studying animal behavior in and out of labs. What I hope to offer you here is a foundational middle school science class level breakdown of the basics to help create a better understanding of critical and often loaded terms like punishment and positive reinforcement. From there, you'll start to see how you are already communicating with your dogs and shaping their behavior and how you can do so more effectively. Part 3 brings the discussion back to the dog in front of you. I'll give you a 3-pronged approach that involves curating an environment conducive to learning and then using appropriate reinforcers delivered with thoughtful timing to get behaviors you want to happen in that environment. Part 4 is about going forward with everything you've learned. I'll help you consider your next steps in training as a dog owner, whether you have hours or minutes in a day to do it. I've lived both scenarios. This last part is also a bit of a meditation on pet ownership and what it says about our existence in an ever-changing world. Because good dog training is nothing less than creating the conditions for a better, safer, kinder, and more encouraging world for all animals, humans included. If you detect an urban slant to this book, it's probably because I am a native New Yorker, and for years my bread and butter has been working with people who have city dogs. However, even if you're not a city dweller, this perspective can be helpful. A suburban, even pastoral bias pervades traditional dog training, assuming everyone has, for example, access to wide open spaces for teaching recall or lives in a freestanding house where they can let a puppy bark it out without disturbing the neighbors. At School for the Dogs, we specialize not so much in working with tough dogs, but in working with dogs in a tough situation, a big, crowded, noisy city. Urban dogs and their humans are under particular stress due to the literal confines of apartment life and tight sidewalks and condo boards. The non-urban dweller who uses our approach is swinging a weighted bat. It's like the song says, if you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. Start spreading the peanut butter. Part 1. How we've been getting it wrong. 1. People are weird with dogs. We were making the future, he said, and hardly any of us troubled to think what future we were making. And here it is. H.G. Wells, The Sleeper Awakes. My dad was a bright guy. His favorite day of the week was Tuesday, which was when the New York Times published its science section. He loved turning daily activities into experiments. Let's boil 5 eggs and remove them at 30-second intervals to see which has the best consistency for eating. Let's see how many languages we can learn to count in, with our only teachers being cab drivers. He was also unusually kind. He rarely said anything mean about anyone, and his generosity was epic. No matter how broke he was, dinner was always on him. When a blackout left people marooned in his Manhattan neighborhood during the summer of 2003, his girlfriend had to keep him from inviting random people on the street to sleep on the couch. He was also a bohemian par excellence, especially in his parenting style. Bedtime was never a thing, ice cream could be considered a meal, and showering was optional. There was a very long runway I could go down before he ever approached being angry with me. And yet, his sweet curiosity and generosity did not always extend to the family pets. In the days living on a farm before I was born, he kept male dogs away from his Doberman when she was in heat by shooting at them with a water gun filled with Tabasco sauce. When our dog Mabel was a puppy and her teeth grazed my arm, he told me to bite her ear like a mother dog would do. I still remember the taste of furry ear. When she barked at sounds in the hall, he had a rolled-up newspaper at the ready. He was such a gentle person that it's hard for me to picture him hitting her, but he must have at some point, as I remember seeing her flinch if he just reached for it. I don't doubt that his techniques worked. Mabel followed him around the apartment slavishly. Master was how he referred to himself in relation to her. And she would hang out the fourth floor window looking for him when he went out. When something works, we're bound to do it again. And whatever he did worked, which is why I can still hear him saying to her, while patting her head as if he were dribbling a basketball, "What a good girl." His intonation was purposeful. He'd explained to me that the W sound was very meaningful to dogs, so it was important to draw it out. Indeed, the clear pronunciation of all consonants mattered in training, he said. That is also why he'd make a great effort to pronounce the T when he told Mabel to sit. Sit. She'd sit. Whether it was because of the T or because the rolled newspaper was in sight, I couldn't say. The summer after my dad died, I was puttering around my kitchen with YouTube going in the background on my laptop. I don't remember what I had on, but it was something relating to dog training, and I was only half paying attention. It ended, and the algorithm chose something to play next. I had my back turned and was vaguely aware of an announcer with a stodgy British accent in the video, and then I heard something that made coffee come out of my nose. Sit! On the screen was a woman who looked like Mrs. Doubtfire dressed by the church lady. Stiff and white-haired, she had a lilting voice like the Dowager Countess from Downton Abbey, but sounded like my dad. I couldn't look away. What I was watching was actually from a British show that aired on PBS in the 1970s and 1980s. To make a dog sit, you have got to learn the right signal and the right tone of voice. Sit, the woman says, bending her arm toward her shoulder in a two-part motion, in rhythm with the syllables. Then there's a montage of everyone from 1980s talk show hosts to the Bee Gees either saying, sit, or receiving the command. And then we see the woman, Barbara Woodhouse, admonishing the owners who aren't pronouncing their T's clearly enough or aren't jerking the leashes with enough vim. But occasionally she'd soften, and when she did, it was a consonant on the other side of the interjection that got drawn out. What a good girl. Listener, I binged. I watched, incredulous, as she suggested to one woman that she leave her Alsatian tied to a retractable leash in the yard all day if she goes out, then showed a Scotty owner how to walk bent over in order to better be able to shake a plastic bag at the dog's behind to keep him from stopping during a walk. In one of the most memorable episodes, we meet a Doberman who chases bikes. To solve the problem, she enlists a bicycle.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?